as the war enters its 46th day. Hamas praises recent seizure of an Israeli vessel by Yemeni Navy as a victory for Palestine. New Orleans Foreign Minister calls for international measures to protect lives of Palestinian children amid Israel's brutal aggression on the Gaza Strip. Hello everyone, and thanks for tuning in to World News. Israel's brutal war on the besieged Gaza Strip is now in its 46th day. Nothing, no one, and nowhere has been spared. Hospitals, however, have become the focal point of Israel's fatal raids. The health ministry says in Gaza, regime military is firing nonstop at the Indonesian hospital. The ministry expressed concerns about another Israeli massacre where at least a dozen Palestinians were killed late Monday. Meanwhile, charity group Doctors Without Borders has expressed deep concerns about the situation at Al-Shifa Hospital, which is also scenes of recent Israeli massacre. The MSF says some of its staff are still in the hospital facility and unable to leave amid Israel's continued siege and deadly attacks. Elsewhere, in south of the Gaza Strip, the city of Khan Yunis remains under Israel's heavy bombardment. Israel launched its brutal war on Gaza on October 7th. Since then, regime's attacks have killed over 13,300 Palestinians. Regime stands accused of committing genocide in Gaza and rejects growing calls to bring a halt to its carnage in the Palestinian territory. Meanwhile, the World Health Organization sounded the alarm about the humanitarian situation in Gaza. It warns about the risk of disease outbreak as Israel continues its relentless bombing of the Palestinian enclave.
I would continue to describe the humanitarian health situation as catastrophic. Our main concern is ensuring that the people of Gaza get access to health care, both urgent health care for the large number of traumatic injuries as a result of the war, and also other essential health services, such as obstetric care for the 180-odd women that are going to be delivering every day, particularly those needing a cesarean section or having a complication of their pregnancy. Similarly, we need to be providing care for those with chronic conditions, high blood pressure, heart disease, and diabetes. We're also extremely concerned about the risk of disease outbreaks because of the overcrowding. We've got over 1.5 million people displaced, very large proportion of them in these overcrowded, unsanitary schools and collective centers where there is limited access to clean water, where limited access to food. There is very, very, very poor sanitation, toilets overflowing, open defecation, and we're already starting to see increased rates of infections, such as respiratory infections, diarrhea, jaundice now, suggesting possible hepatitis, childhood infections, terrible skin infections like scabies.
Military wing of Hamas says the Israeli military has bombed some of its own forces in Gaza. The Al-Qassam spokesperson Abu Ubaidah was referring to the so-called Hannibal Directive, an Israeli military policy aimed at preventing capture of its soldiers by enemy forces at any cost. In a pre-recorded statement, Ubaidah said fierce clashes rage on in several fronts in Gaza, with Al-Qassam fighters inflicting casualties on Israeli soldiers. He also said resistance fighters fired missiles into Tel Aviv, with the media saying it was one of the heaviest attacks on the city. Israeli forces are facing fierce resistance from Palestinian groups as the regime continues its ground operation inside of Gaza. The Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah says it's hit Israeli military outposts in the northern parts of occupied territories. Hezbollah says it struck Birani base headquarters of Israel's 91st Division with heavy caliber Burkan rockets. Attacks left casualties among Israeli forces. 25 other launches were reported from Lebanon into occupied territories on Monday. The movement says attacks against Israel will continue until it stops its war crimes against Palestinians. Area along the southern Lebanese border has been witnessing exchanges of fire between Hezbollah and Israel since October 8th. That's a day after Palestinians launched Operation Al-Aqsa Flood against Israel. The Yemeni military has released footage of an operation it performed on Sunday to seize an Israeli vessel in the Red Sea. Yemeni armed forces say they seized the ship with all of its crew in response to Israeli massacre of Palestinians in Gaza. Hamas also hailed the move as a victory for Palestinians. Head of its political bureau overseas, Sami Abu Zuri, called seizure of the Galaxy leader in the Red Sea a great achievement by the Yemenis. He added, "Move should set an example for all Islamic countries." Yemen's answer, the movement had already warned that it will target all ships associated with Israel in regional waters. Meanwhile, Hamas rejects as misleading and false allegations it's holding Israeli captives at Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza City. Hamas said the Israeli regime is trying to cover up for its military failures by leveling such allegations, adding those claims are in line with the regime's campaign of lies and misinformation. The movement noted many of the injured captives were sent to Al-Shifa for treatment and then returned to their places of detention. On Sunday, the Israeli military released videos showing Israeli captives being taken to Al-Shifa hospital complex, claiming Hamas is holding them inside the facility. The claim is in line with the regime's accusation that Hamas headquarters is located underneath the hospital, which has been denied by the resistance group. The Palestinian Ministry of Education has called on countries and institutions to protect the right of Palestinian children to life and education in the face of Israeli atrocities. The ministry made the call on the occasion of World Children's Day. It said killing of children and students in Gaza and the occupied West Bank violates all norms and conventions. Iran's foreign minister also called for immediate and practical measures to protect the lives of Palestinian children. Hossein Amir Abdullahian said failure to take such action would be a major and regrettable tragedy. Israel has killed over 5,600 children, including 3,000 students, in its war on Gaza since October 7th. Iran's permanent ambassador to the UN has slammed the Security Council for failing to include a call for a ceasefire in its recently approved resolution on Israel's war on the Gaza Strip.
There is generally an expectation that the content of the Security Council resolution should have included the main elements of the resolution of the General Assembly that was adopted with a majority of 121 votes, especially its key point that there is a most urgent need for an immediate, sustainable, and durable truce for civilians.
Yerevan is speaking at the informal plenary meeting of the General Assembly on the humanitarian situation in the Gaza Strip. He added that the Security Council resolution failed to stop Israel's war and atrocities in Gaza as it lacked an executive guarantee and was not legally binding. The Iranian UN envoy said despite resolution's approval, the regime continues its deadly attacks against civilians. Yerevani urged UN to support the people of Gaza in the face of Israel's war crimes.
Gaza is experiencing a challenging time, and the people of Gaza are facing unabated war crimes and crimes against humanity by the Israeli regime. The people of Gaza expect concrete support from the United Nations. Their land is still under occupation, and they continue to suffer from Israel's vicious war, despite worldwide calls for ceasefire.
The Iranian ambassador described Gaza's situation as dire and catastrophic, noting sympathy with Palestinians in Gaza is no longer enough. Israeli crimes in Gaza have been committed under protection of the U.S. Washington is also resisting calls for a ceasefire in Gaza since Israel launched its brutal war on the blockaded strip. Protesters throughout the world voice support for Palestinians as the Israeli killing campaign in Gaza shows no sign of abating. In Valencia, Spain, hundreds of protesters hit the streets waving the Palestinian flags and calling for a boycott of the Israeli regime. Participants carried effigies of shrouded babies as a sign of Israel killing more than 5,000 Palestinian children in Gaza. In the Swedish capital, Stockholm, a large number of people took to the streets to show solidarity with Palestinians and chanted slogans for freedom of occupied territory. Demonstrators in Copenhagen, Denmark, also called for an end to Israel's genocidal war on Gazans. Milan, London, Geneva, Lisbon, Beirut, and Sana'a were also scenes of pro-Palestine rallies a day earlier.
Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau is under mounting pressure as protests against the Israeli onslaught of the besieged Gaza Strip enter a sixth week. Demonstrators underline that it's not just the U.S. president and Israeli prime minister behind the killings of thousands of people in Gaza, saying that their government is also complicit in Israel's atrocities.
We're seeing an intensification of our people's struggle. Zionism is falling in front of our eyes. People are refusing to believe Zionist lies about the Palestinian people, about Gaza. Our numbers are growing every single week. We are seeing people all across the world take up more intense forms of direct action, refusing to be quiet, even though 6 weeks in, the Canadian government and Western governments have not called for a ceasefire, continue to send weapons to the Zionist state.
The International Center of Justice for Palestinians has announced its intention to seek the prosecution of four Canadian officials, including the Prime Minister. The organization says it will pursue all appropriate courses of action to hold them accountable before the International Criminal Court for supporting the Israeli regime.
So this case is part of a larger international collaboration to bring charges for aiding and abetting against Canadian officials who have been complicit with Israeli war crimes. All of them in their own way have been either acting or failing to act in a way that is benefiting the Israeli armed forces with great intentionality. And what we see right now is we see a situation where arms are still being shipped from Canada to Israel while it's carrying out war crimes. We see money being misappropriated from so-called charitable organizations here and being sent over to assist the occupation forces. We also see the government here failing to do anything at all to stop recruitment for the Israeli military, which is also happening right now.
Activists are calling for an immediate ceasefire in the Palestinian territory to prevent further loss of life and say that Ottawa must cancel all arms export permits to Israel and require the regime to fully comply with international law.
So we refuse for our Canadian leadership, the members that we elected, to be complicit in the ethnic cleansing of the Palestinians. We demand that it imposes an arms embargo on Israel and that it holds it accountable to the numerous international law violations and war crimes that it has committed, not only the past 42 days, but for the past 75 years of occupation.
If the politicians and the media will not listen to us, then we will make it impossible for them to ignore us. We will not allow for business to go on as usual while a genocide takes place against our people in Gaza.
These mass protests demonstrate that people here and around the world no longer believe Israel's propaganda as people from across the country prepare for next week's national march on Ottawa. Camila Escalante, Toronto.
As Israel continues its relentless bombardment of Gaza, the regime has also stepped up its crackdown on the occupied West Bank. It's killed over 200 Palestinians there and made thousands of arrests. Harassment of Palestinians by Israeli settlers has also seen a sharp increase. It's feared the regime is using the crisis in Gaza to also press ahead with its ethnic cleansing campaign in the occupied West Bank.
As the world is watching a genocide unfolding in the Gaza Strip, another massacre is taking place against the Palestinian people in the occupied West Bank. Since the Israeli offensive began on the Gaza Strip on October 7, the violence against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank has also escalated. Israeli forces have killed dozens of Palestinians there. The Israelis have cut off Palestinian villages and cities from one another by closures and settler attacks. That has resulted in a near standstill of commercial activities of Palestinians and their movements. Furthermore, armed settlers backed by regime troops have blocked entrances to most Palestinian villages, towns, and cities through military checkpoints, earth mounds, cement blocks, and iron gates. During the current offensive, the rate of violence practiced by settlers against Palestinians has escalated. That includes preventing them from accessing their lands, attacking them while picking olives, expelling them from their fields, and harassing Palestinians moving on roads.
We used to have problems with the settlers, but after the war in Gaza, they want to kill all of us.
After the war, the situation changed. They started attacking our houses. They didn't used to come to our houses. They started attacking them and the people inside them.
Preventing access to water and food needs, especially in the herding communities, is done by Israel with the aim of displacing the Palestinian communities in those areas.
We have the same occupation and we are the same people. Geography does not, you know, divide people. We are just the same. We are all targets. Whenever you are a Palestinian, you are a terrorist and you should be killed. People are killed for no reason and for nothing. So, you know, this is complete genocide. This is complete war crimes that should be stopped immediately, right now.
Just days ago, Jordan warned against Israel's plans to displace Palestinians living in the occupied West Bank to the Arab Kingdom, saying that Amman would consider the move, quote, a declaration of war. The warning refers to a decades-old plan dating back to before the creation of Israel in 1948. This transfer plan, originally formulated by Zionist militias operating in Palestine and then endorsed by the regime after its creation, calls for mass expulsion of Palestinians to Egypt's Sinai Desert. After Israel's occupation of the West Bank in 1967, the idea of pushing Palestinians towards Jordan became included in the transfer plan.
There's also been a sharp increase in settler violence and takeover of land across the West Bank. Since 7 October, nearly 1,000 Palestinians from at least 15 herding communities have been forced from their homes. In the context of the coercive environment they live in, the displacement of these communities may amount to the forcible transfer of a population, which is a grave breach of the Fourth Geneva Convention.
Thanks for tuning in, and bye-bye for now.
Bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
The judge overseeing Donald Trump's civil fraud trial has said the former president's motion for a mistrial is utterly without merit, denying his effort to be heard on the issue. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The national broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. The judge presiding over former President Donald Trump's New York fraud case rejected a motion on Friday, 17th of November, seeking to have a mistrial declared. Donald Trump's attorneys made the request on Thursday, 16th of November, claiming Judge Arthur Engoron and his law clerk had displayed bias and that he conferred with her so much it was as if they were co-judging the case. Judge Arthur Engoron explicitly denied that claim on Friday and called the motion without any merit. "My rulings are mine and mine alone. There is absolutely no co-judging at play," Judge Engoron wrote. The judge and his clerk, Alison Greenfield, have been the subject of fierce criticism by Trump and his lawyers, who claim they have overwhelmingly favored New York Attorney General Letitia James' side in the case. The trial, which began on 2nd of October and is expected to last well into December, stems from a September 2022 lawsuit in which New York Attorney General Letitia James' office alleges that Trump, two of his sons, and their company engaged in a decade of fraud tied to Trump's financial statements. Letitia James is seeking $250 million for the state and additional penalties that would restrict the defendant's ability to do business in New York. Judge Arthur Engoron found the defendants liable for fraud in a pretrial ruling. The trial is proceeding on other allegations related to falsification of business records, conspiracy and insurance fraud, and the appropriate damages and penalties to be imposed. Judge Engoron ruled that Donald Trump and his campaign twice violated a limited gag order the judge put in place on 3rd of October, after Trump posted a derogatory statement on social media sites about Greenfield. He's been ordered to pay $15,000 in fines related to the gag order violations. In the motion for a mistrial, the Trump attorneys complained that Judge Engoron consulted too frequently with Alison Greenfield. Trump's attorneys announced plans to file it the day he testified in the case on 6th of November, capping off an intense day of examination in which Trump, who has frequently criticized Judge Engoron and his clerk, even lashed out at the judge from the witness stand, pointing at him and calling him a fraud. In the court filing, Trump's attorneys claimed that the court has abrogated his constitutional responsibility to ensure that each defendant, including President Trump, receives a fair trial free from even the appearance of impropriety and impartiality. Judge Engoron wrote that he has an absolute, unfettered right to consult with my law clerks in any way, shape, or form that I choose. The Attorney General had proposed a briefing schedule to address the mistrial motion, but Judge Engoron ruled that was unnecessary, calling the motion itself without any merit and writing, "Subsequent briefing would therefore be futile." Trump legal spokesperson Alina Hubba said, "As expected, today the court refused to take responsibility for its failure to preside over this case in an impartial and unbiased manner. We, however, remain undeterred and will continue to fight for our client's right to a fair trial." CNN Cable News Network has also covered this story and tells us more. The judge overseeing Donald Trump's civil fraud trial said the former president's motion for a mistrial is utterly without merit, denying his effort to be heard on the issue. Judge Arthur Engoron responded in a written order to Trump's claim earlier this week that the judge and his principal law clerk are biased against him. In the court filing, Trump's team cited the judge's rulings, commentary, and his law clerk's political activities. Trump asked the judge to grant an order to show cause, which would allow Trump and the New York Attorney General's office to make legal briefings and be heard on the issue. The Attorney General's team didn't object to a briefing schedule, but said they didn't want it to interfere with the trial, which is expected to finish next month. On Friday, 17th of November, Judge Ngoron said there was no point for a briefing as he stands by his rulings and defended his law clerk's political activities, including donations that she made whilst campaigning for office, saying they fell within the appropriate limits. "I cannot sign a proposed order to show cause that is utterly without merit, and upon which subsequent briefing would therefore be futile," the judge wrote. "I stand by each and every ruling that I made, and they speak for themselves." Judge Ngoron added, "There is absolutely no co-judging at play here." The decision came the day after a New York appeals court judge temporarily lifted Ngoron's gag order on Trump and his attorneys to prohibit them from making statements about his law clerk. The American newspaper The Hill has also covered this same story. A New York judge has denied former President Donald Trump's motion for a mistrial in his civil fraud case, rejecting the claim that the judge and his principal law clerk had tainted the trial with bias. Judge Arthur Ngoron issued a scathing rebuke to Trump's mistrial motion on Friday afternoon, 17th of November, describing it as utterly without merit. He defended the political donations of his law clerk and his own extrajudicial posts online to a school alumni website that came under fire by the former president's defense team. "I stand by each and every ruling, and they speak for themselves," Judge Ngoron wrote in the 6-page decision. The judge accused Trump's counsel of cherry-picking purported evidence of misconduct without showing the full picture. The mistrial motion cited a comment made by Judge Ngoron during Trump's testimony that the judge was not here to hear what Donald Trump has to say, but excluded his next sentence, which contextualized that comment. "Such argument is disingenuous and made in bad faith, as defendants omitted what I said immediately after that sentence, which is, 'I'm here to hear him answer questions,'" Judge Ngoron wrote. "Indeed, those are precisely the roles of the witness and the finder of fact." That the judge had shared links about the case on his school alumni website also drew the ire of Donald Trump's legal counsel, which Judge Ngoron objected to by asserting that none of this has anything to do with, much less does it interfere with, my presiding fairly, impartially, and professionally over the instant dispute. His clerk, who has become an unwitting main character in the fraud trial, was also targeted in the mistrial motion, which suggested that she has been given unprecedented and inappropriate latitude to act as a co-judge in the case. The law clerk frequently confers with Judge Ngoron via whispers and written notes, frequently before orders are issued. "There is absolutely no co-judging at play here," Judge Ngoron wrote. Trump's counsel also accused the clerk of making partisan political contributions in excess of strict limits, including to groups that oppose Donald Trump and support New York Attorney General Letitia James. Judge Ngoron took to his clerk's defense in his order, again accusing Donald Trump's lawyers of presenting arguments lacking context. He cited a judicial ethics opinion asserting that the contribution limits do not apply to an appointee's contributions to his or her own campaign, nor would there be such a monetary restriction on the purchasing of tickets to political functions. The New York judge also took aim at Donald Trump's counsel for attempting to conflate his clerk's attendance at legally and ethically permitted political events with his own political standing. Judge Ngoron said, "Such arguments are nonsensical, and in any event they are a red herring, as my principal law clerk does not make rulings or issue orders."
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. Welcome back to IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Viewpoint. I am Bita, and once again, I have the chance and opportunity to be at your service as the host of today's episode. And here with me, there are two dear guest speakers, Brother Ali and Sheikh Rouhani. Assalamu alaikum. Welcome back.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
As you know, in this episode, we're going to talk about the superiority of languages and language itself, which for sure is something mysterious after all these years of existence of human beings. Language sets people apart from all other creatures. Every known human society has had a language, and though some non-humans may be able to communicate with one another in fairly complex ways, but still, none of their communication systems begins to approach language and its ability to convey information. So, language for sure is something mysterious, and one thing that I want to put my finger on is about the unity and diversity of the language, which I'm going to elaborate it more. There are many languages and many cultures, all different, but all fundamentally the same. Because there is one human nature, and because a fundamental property of this human nature is the way in which it allows such diversity in both language and culture. So, here the question comes up to our mind that, as we all are aware, Arabic is considered as the most perfect and the most complete language in the world. At this part of our episode, we're going to focus on the influence of Arabic language and European languages, and specifically English. Sheikh Rouhani, let's have your point of view.
Yes, first of all, let me mention this very interesting point about the Arabic language. You know that before the advent of Islam, we do not have even one single page, I mean text in Arabic language, let alone books. You know, the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, we can say out of vacuum, he brought such a masterpiece that we nowadays call Quran. It is the miraculous aspect of the Holy Quran. So out of this kind of language, we see the Holy Quran, we see the narrations, the ahadith, and the language of a new civilization, which is the Islamic civilization. Yeah. So the Islamic civilization was based on Arabic language. The language of Islamic civilization was Arabic. That we can say that later in the medieval, the Westerners, all of them copied the educational systems, the, let's say, literary works, the textbooks, and universities, seminaries, schools, all of them were copied by the Westerners from the Islamic world. And so if you go to the history of establishing the first seminaries in, for example, Spain, you see that all of the students who established those seminaries or schools or universities in Spain, they were all came from Islamic seminaries, from Egypt, from, let's say, Baghdad, from the other, let's say, Islamic seminaries. So the first founders of the universities and colleges in the West, they were all the students of Muslims. Some of them are Muslims, some of them are the students of Islamic seminaries. So it was the language of Islam that had its influence on the Western civilization, because the works of, for example, ancient Greece, they were copied in Arabic, then from Arabic to Western languages. So in the medieval, we see that all the works of, for example, Plato, Aristotle, and the other, let's say, figures, scholarly figures in the West, they were first copied in Arabic language. So Arabic language had this capacity to copy those works. And then from their Arabic sources, the Westerners later, they copied. So, of course, we see this kind of interaction between or kind of communication between Arabic language and the Western languages or Western civilization and Islamic civilization. From this perspective, yes, of course, we see the influence of Arabic language in the culture of the Westerners, particularly in the fields of studies like chemistry, biology, physician, or let's say geometry and this kind of studies, yeah, because it was Muslim scientists, Muslim, let's say, professionals and experts who had works in Arabic, then their works were copied into the Western languages. So nowadays, if you say lots of technical terms, even in their language, are copied from the Arabic terms. For example, alcohol. You see, this is in a completely Arabic term. Al is in al of Arabic that we have in Arabic. Or many other things that if you search in geometry, in math, in physics, in biology, in chemistry, you see that most of them are still there, the technical Arabic terms which were established by Muslim scientists and philosophers. This is the influence of the Arabic language to the most.
Thank you, Sheikh.
Before moving to the next topic, I want to have a comment on what the respected Sheikh was saying. I think it's better to say that Quran perfected the language of Arabic, because the ignorant Arab, or Arab al-Jahiliya, was very strong in Arabic, and they have a developed knowledge of Arabic. And one of the miraculous aspects of Quran is that they knew literature well. That's why Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala does a tahaddi that says, okay, you as the most literate people of the Arabian Peninsula, can you say something in comparison to these words, to these beautiful words? So actually, they found it, knowledgeable poets, knowledgeable literarians, I don't know if the term is good or right or not, the knowledgeable, let's say, people in literature actually found it quite perfect and comprehensive, that they could not bring anything in front of that. So it was, this literature itself was one of the miraculous aspects of it.
You know, in the Arab Peninsula, there were no university, no college,
definitely,
no seminary, no library, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There was even no kingdom,
mm-hmm,
yeah, to establish any seminary, any school, any library, you know.
True.
That is why when we see Quran as a masterpiece that was brought by the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, that's why it was unexpected for the Arab poets. As you rightly mentioned, there were some poets, mm-hmm, and who were very much strong in terms of poetry. They just sometimes composed some nice and beautiful poems, but not other than these poems.
Okay.
You know, that's why their look, their perspective to the Quran was from poetic perspective. While Quran was not poetry.
Definitely.
Quran was totally different. It was neither poetry nor very simple text. It was between that. So that's why we can say that the way and the method that adopted by the Holy Prophet and the Holy Quran was completely new and fresh.
Yeah.
Because it's not the poetry. It's not called copy of their, let's say, rules or composition, for example, rulings of the poetry or the poets or the literary figures of the... Yeah, of course, I do agree with you that there were some poets. There were some literary figures. They were very strong and let's say, very influential at that time. But there were few poets in Arab Peninsula. But if you compare their works with the Holy Quran, you see that the Quran is never comparable or with those kind of works.
Definitely.
Yes.
In comparison to the poems and the, let's say, proses or the literary works that were there, the Quran was something quite special. That's why they actually bent down in front of the literature of the Quran. That's true.
So I think at the end of the day, all of us agree that Quran has a specific kind of miraculous part, which is because of its a fresh method of expressing words and contents to people, which wasn't seen in the poets and scholars in Arabic, ummah. But the point is, there is a beautiful kind of announcement for people in Arab countries that if you have something better than this, if you have the power to tell only one sentence, exactly the same as whatever we have in Holy Quran, then do it. And it is because of this importance of literature at that time in Arabic countries that even in their fight, they were fighting with words and poets and literature. Up to here, to summarize everything, we talked about the potentials, capacities, importance of Arabic language, and this religious aspect of the language of Holy Quran, which is Arabic and so on. So here is a question that, as Muslims, should we learn Arabic language in order to be a better Muslim, in order to actually learn and know more about Holy Quran or not?
Yeah,
Sheikh Rouhani.
Should I answer? Okay. Before answering your question, I want to just mention one point, which is really important.
I'm all ears.
If the language of Quran were, for example, if this language was Chinese or Indian or Greece or Latin or Hebrew, you know, if it were any other language, then of course none of the people would accept the Quran.
Why is it so?
Because of what? Because they would say, okay, you copied the teachings of Confucius, for example, from China. You copied, for example, the ideas of Indian figures, for example, Hinduism or Buddhism.
So you mean there were no famous scholars in Arabic countries?
Arabic language was chosen because there were no such, let's say, influential works. You know, we have, for example, the works of Confucianism
in
China.
So why not Farsi?
Even in Farsi, we had some, let's say, what is called Khudainameh. Khudainameh, before Shahnameh, we had many other Khudainameh. Shahnameh is a copy of them. So then we had these kind of words in Farsi, in, let's say, Hebrew, and let's say Latin, in Chinese, in maybe Indian language. In all of these works, we had lots of works. If the Quran was revealed in any of these languages, then the people would say, okay, this prophet learned this language and copied the ideas of the others. That's why the Quran is, in terms of the language, is new. And also in terms of the content, the content of this Quran is completely new and fresh. That's why it is the miraculous aspect of the Holy Quran, okay? This was what I wanted to mention. But then when it comes to the learning of Arabic language, no, it's not necessary. It's not mandatory for non-Muslims to learn this language. None of the jurists or fuqaha said such, that Muslims should learn or must learn the Arabic language. No, there's no need. But of course, when it comes to recitation of some verses of the Holy Quran that we recite in namaz, and in our prayer and salat, of course, it is better. It's better that we should recite and pronounce the words of prayer as much as we could, similar to the way that the, for example, the Holy Prophet or the Ahlul Bayt pronounce in the Arabic language. But again, it's not obligatory. It's not mandatory on Muslims. It's better to, it's mustahab, it's recommended. But if someone cannot pronounce, if someone cannot learn this language, there's no problem. He can read, as you see many of the Maraja now when they read namaz and their prayers, maybe the Arabs would say, so your pronunciation is problematic. But no, there's no problem with that. According to the fuqaha, there's no problem.
Thank you.
Just to distinguish, for example, between some of the specific letters in Arabic whose pronunciation is different, that's enough. But it's not mandatory, it's not obligatory to learn Arabic language.
Thank you, Sheikh Rouhani, for your clarification. And Brother Ali, you have only 1 minute to add whatever you want to this topic.
Learning Arabic, though, as the respected brother said, is not mandatory and obligatory on us, but it is highly recommended for us to learn it. Why? We can get in touch with the Islamic sources, whatever we have from Islamic sources, from Quran to the words of Ahlul Bayt, the narrations, everything is in Arabic. If we want to claim that we learn something from Islam and we can infer something from Islam, we need to be in touch with Islamic sources and books. So I think for the man of knowledge, to some certain people, not all, is sometimes even compulsory for them to learn, because they want to actually get directly in touch with the Islamic teachings. But as the brother said, no, it's not mandatory for everyone to get. But the total words that we need to learn for our daily prayers and for all our worship and rituals are almost altogether 20 words with missing, losing the commonalities.
Yeah, thank you, Brother Lee.
Minus the commonalities, and it's not that difficult for anyone from any race, from any, let's say, community to learn these 20 words of a foreign language that we have it. I mean, we are facing different foreign words in our languages daily. More than thousands of them are being read and repeated in our words in a daily basis.
Thank you. Thank you both, Brother Ali and Sheikh Rouhani, for being with me in this episode. And thank you, dear listeners, for listening to us. And you can listen to more episodes on page Call of Islam. And that's it. I hope you enjoyed the whole episode. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
shining bright, you came to us with a heart so full of love, and you showed that you're the one who cares the most, and to us you've always been so close. Everyone will say, please save me, accept Al-Habib. Ummati, Ummati, yakuluha lana yawma al-qiyamati. Ummati, Ummati, yakuluha shafa'atan ana laha.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
The International Monetary Fund, the IMF, said that Germany will suffer a deeper recession than previously thought, predicting that Europe's traditional growth engine will be worst performing major economy in 2023. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Bloomberg News Agency has covered the story and tells us more. According to forecasters, Germany won't escape a second recession this year as the economy, long seen as Europe's motor, limps through persisting industrial weakness. Bloomberg's survey of economists shows gross domestic product or GDP declined 0.2% in the quarter through to September and will probably fall a further 0.1% before the end of 2023. Dennis Hutschersmeier, a senior economist at Handelsblatt Research Institute in Düsseldorf, Germany, said economic growth will be weak for many years due to several structural problems. Consequently, the German economy will shrink this year and faces lackluster growth in subsequent years. The collective outlook suggests that Germany will have suffered 5 consecutive quarters without any expansion at all. That underscores how sluggish Chinese export demand and an energy crisis have made Europe's biggest economy stand out from its regional peers as a dead weight. That status has revived comparisons with the 1990s, when the country was labelled as a sick man of the region. The forecast showed Germany's gross domestic product or GDP will drop 0.4% in 2023 and rebound just 0.5% next year. That's a much weaker bounce back than anticipated in fresh predictions from the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, and the German government, for 0.9% and 1.3% respectively. Whatever the outcome next year, the country's prospects continue to trouble global finance officials. Oya Selasun, deputy director of the International Monetary Fund's European Department, told reporters on Friday, 13th of October, in the Moroccan city of Marrakesh, "We see long-standing challenges to growth. There's quite a few things that Germany must work on." In an interview with Bloomberg Television's Francine Lacroix on the same day, Deutsche Bank chief executive officer Christian Sewing said the country needs structural reforms with regard to energy prices, with regard to infrastructure, immigration and so on. Deutsche Bank chief executive officer Christian Sewing added, "If we do this, I think Germany will see growth again," adding that potentially not the number which we will wish in 2024, but from 2025. Agence France-Presse news agency has also covered the same story and tells us more. The International Monetary Fund, the IMF, said on Tuesday, 10th of October, that Germany will suffer a deeper recession than previously thought, predicting that Europe's traditional growth engine will be the worst-performing major economy in 2023. The International Monetary Fund said the German economy, buffeted by high inflation and a manufacturing slump, is now expected to shrink by 0.5% this year. It had forecast a 0.3% contraction back in July. The updated forecast confirms Europe's largest economy will be the only one of the group of seven rich nations not to grow this year. The International Monetary Fund said in its latest report, Germany faces multiple headwinds, including weakness in interest rate-sensitive sectors and slower trading partner demand. According to the International Monetary Fund, the country, which tipped into recession at the start of 2023 and stagnated in the second quarter of this year, is headed for another slight economic contraction in the second half of the year. The Washington-based Institute sees Germany rebounding in 2024, but downgraded its expectations to 0.9% growth from July's 1.3% growth. Germany's troubles are set to act as a drag on Eurozone growth, with the International Monetary Fund slightly lowering its 2023 forecast for the 20-nation currency club to 0.7% growth. There was better news for Eurozone other heavyweight France, where a catch-up in industrial production and external demand led the International Monetary Fund to predict 1% expansion for 2023, up from 0.8% previously. But fellow G7 member Italy, grappling with inflation stubbornly above the Eurozone average, saw its economic growth prediction slashed by 0.4 percentage points to 0.7%. Elevated energy prices linked to the war in Ukraine, higher borrowing costs as a result of the European Central Bank's interest rate hikes to cool inflation, and weaker demand from China are all taking a toll on export powerhouse Germany. The end of cheap Russian gas imports has rattled Germany's energy-intensive sectors in particular, provoking much hand-wringing about a potential deindustrialization as companies mull whether to move production abroad. Euronews has also covered the same story and tells us more. Germany's government said recently that it expects the country's economy to shrink by as much as 0.4% this year, joining a string of other forecasters in revising sharply downwards its outlook for Europe's biggest economy. The German economy minister, Robert Habeck, said, "We've had a difficult year economically at a difficult time. The cause, the energy price crisis, the need for the European Central Bank to fight inflation, and the weakening of important global economic partners, such as China." The revised forecast contrasted with a 0.4% growth that the government predicted in late April. The German economy minister, Robert Habeck, added, "We're emerging from the crisis more slowly than expected, but we have reached the low point and we will be moving forward again." The government predicted that gross domestic product, or GDP, would increase by 1.3% next year and 1.5% in 2025, helped by a decline in inflation. That is expected to average 6.1% this year, but drop to 2.6% next year and 2% in 2025. The economy minister said it expects the economy to pick up around the turn of the year and then accelerate, helped by recovering consumer demand. It acknowledged that the necessary fighting of inflation by the European Central Bank, the ECB, which has resulted in a higher borrowing cost, has been a factor in Germany's difficulties. Germany has also been grappling with other issues such as aging population, lagging use of digital technology in business and government, excessive red tape that holds back business launches and public construction projects, and a shortage of skilled labour.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Death toll from Israel's brutal aggression against Gaza, a top